Okay, I'm here with Cameron. I'm Bob Dobbs. This is January 14th, 2021, and this is the 10th recording that Cameron and I have done the past few months. Okay, so Cameron, we were doing my charts. You were hoping I could elucidate them, and I did the two charts made in 1985, bottom-up and top-down charts. And then 10 years later, I was inspired to put the top-down and bottom-up and other factors together and involve more than McLuhan. So I read a lot of other people in that period, 85 to 95. So they bounce off each other nicely. So I found a way to integrate them, sort of. Each part is a spinning gyroscope, I'd say. So if you go, well, you'd have to ask us where these are, but you go to Ian and Bob, scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, look for something that says Bob Dobbs's charts, and click on that, and then go down to the bottom of a whole bunch of charts vertically laid out for you until you get to the Bob Dobbs formula chart pretty well at the bottom. So this was the chart that the famous Tiny Note chart, which is the one, the Tiny Note chart, that I popularized beginning with presenting it in Flipside magazine in 95, 96. And that's the one I would talk about, but not many people knew it came from another chart. Only if they quizzed me and got into it would I tell them where it came from. So this is the Bob Dobbs formula chart. And when I say formula, I'm thinking of McLuhan in Interior Landscape, the book The Interior Landscape, in his essay on Wyndham Lewis. He talked about the modern artist, and that's the first half of the 20th century, like the scientist has a formula, develops a formula. Which is interesting. You remember that section in the Wyndham Lewis?
Yes.
Essay? It's an important statement by him. It's part of his putting on the scientific formula tendency. So this was my formula chart. So it's organized around the, I guess it's the ground, parents in Finnegan's Wake. There is a family. Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker has a family, which has two sons who are twins and a daughter. And he's married to Anna Olivia Plurabelle. So I decided to make the female character the ground, as shown in the bottom-up and top-down charts 10 years before. And HCE would be the other half of the ground, or another ground, but I have it laid out on the chart as ALP is half of the stage, and HCE is the other half of the stage, and stage means the ground, taking off of McLuhan's global theater, but it is moving into the global membrane, which will become the Android meme, so that the stage is figure, half figure, let's say. And then the children are figures on a more ephemeral level. So a bunch of ratios going on here. So
could we say, Bob, that the ALP and the HCE grounds are one half stages because they're in dynamic interaction, that one is constantly becoming the ground at the expense of the other, and the children then represent a kind of dancing effect of that constantly changing ground.
Maybe you should explain these charts. That was pretty good. Yes, I agree. You said one-half stages. I think the word was stages that I didn't hear clearly, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That, and you, that was what you have in the chart.
Yes.
One-half stage for ALP and one-half stage for HCE. And the, and it's important to consider the ramifications of stage. Because
yes.
on the one hand, it's like a theatrical stage in which you might say time has been suspended, where you have what McLuhan sometimes called the figures of being in some kind of Moorish dance performing for us. And on the other hand, stage has a temporal meaning. And I think you have in mind both of those ideas of stage.
Exactly. Did you say Moorish dancing?
Moorish dance, yeah.
You mean in the in Africa?
Yes. He, I think it's Wordsworth uses the phrase Maurice dance, and elsewhere McLuhan talks about a Moorish dance, which is what Wordsworth was referring to with Maurice. And the idea is that a Moorish dance is comparable to the Italian comedic stage with its set characters.
Right.
So the what McLuhan had in mind with the Moorish dance is a constant change of the same.
Okay, but are you referring also to the Moors, M-O-O-R-S, of North Africa?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Okay, the other meaning of stage that I had in mind was in Laws of Media, McLuhan's tetrad, I think, on the Global Village, or I'm not sure what it was, maybe you can remember, but it flips into your credit card as your stage. You remember that?
Interesting. No, I don't, but it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Their stage is a ground, but a funny ground, right?
Yeah.
It's a ground that other people determine and that
yes.
you contribute to without knowing it.
Right, and it can mean that the stage, everything's disappeared visually. You're part of the electric circuitry. You've merged with it almost. And so you're
right.
in the circuitry of the credit card.
Yeah.
So the credit card is your
yeah.
stage. So that's
yeah.
something in the tetrads that no one's ever commented on. It's really important, I think. I'll have to
sure.
look it up for you, see where that can
and
happen.
It's definitely what you mean by half stage.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
The tetrad has a inherent movement between the four corners, and that inherent movement is what I think you're getting at with half stage in your chart.
Exactly. Okay, so remember about 1977, this became available during the centenary of McLuhan in 2011. The Australian Broadcasting Company had a neat interview with McLuhan in 77 in Australia, where it was the first time he ever publicly said it. He was talking about Finnegan's Wake, where in the book, Joyce, or radio program, Joyce presented the media as characters. Have you ever seen that interview?
Definitely. And I don't remember the exact conversation that you're talking about, but I remember in general him getting into that topic.
Yeah, which
yeah.
was important. I always wanted him
yeah.
to talk more about that in public, but
mm-hmm.
it ended up we had to go into Eric McLuhan's PhD work to get details on the Thunders and Finnegan's Wake and media's characters. So so with that in mind, you know, I've got the five members of the family, and the bottom-up chart is ALP, and that's what it says under one-half stage. Bottom-up ground effects... the person that did this spelt it wrong. They got preceding causes. Should be effects preceding causes, P-R-E.
Yeah.
So I have to get that corrected. So then on the far right, you have the top-down chart extension. So it's called top-down bureaucratic ground, and it has causes in quotes merging with effects. And when you have causes in quotes, one is referring to page 137 of Take Today at the very bottom, where he quotes, puts cause and effects in italics or in quote marks at different points in a paragraph. It's very important to be able to read the levels. Do you know what I mean? When,
yes, sir.
In that sentence. That's probably one of his most complex sentences. Of course, the figures are like the figures in bottom-up and top-down charts, but I specify them as actors. And they are retrievals or interiorization. Interiorization refers to the early formula McLuhan developed where when movies came in, the novel became art form. Or when television came in, movies became art form. You know what I mean? So,
yep.
So that's the meaning of actors, and then in brackets, retrieval slash interiorization. Interiorization, I think the way McLuhan used it, he meant the art form process. Does that go with you?
Yes.
Okay.
One thing we should note is that when you specify these actors and you're following Joyce in doing that, you have an important theme that McLuhan was thinking about very early and that he may have taken up from Carl Jung. And that is the idea that the dominance of the psyche are persons in their own right, and that all of personality, in fact, is something that comes to us, not from us. So that we make a kind of character mistake when we think of ourselves as controlling subjects, when really we are controlled subjects.
Yes, I agree. And you have persona. What was the name for the mask for actors in Greek theater 2,000 years ago? Right?
Yes, sir.
It's a mask. Now, the formula is above these names. Very top, I have co-evolutionary anticipatory mimesis. And I was thinking of McLuhan's use of anticipatory in early 70s when he talked about anticipatory democracy versus participatory democracy. Okay, so I had that in mind, or quoting him there. Coevolutionary anticipatory mimesis equals how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics. And fit the Battle of Jericho is a phrase from a McLuhan essay in about issue number 5 of his explorations in the 50s. Maybe even, right. You know the date? The media fit the Battle of Jericho.
Yeah, 55, I think.
Yeah. And he also talks in another essay, the media as political art form. So that's why I add in American politics. So I'm thinking of different McLuhan titles when I put that together.
Let's just talk about that top line, that top title line per minute. I'll tell you how I read it, and then you can tell me if I get it right or wrong.
Right.
So by anticipatory mimesis, I think what he's talking about is knowing the effects of causes and being able to act knowing those effects, as opposed to now, where we act before knowing and then get hung up in the effects that we didn't know were coming. And then that equals how the media archetypes fit in the Battle of Jericho, because in order to know the effects by way of anticipation, we have to know how the media archetypes fit together. And note that the word fit in Fit the Battle of Jericho is very ambiguous.
Yeah.
When I say how the archetypes fit together, what I'm talking about is the fact that since the dominance of subjectivity, both individually and collectively, come to us rather than from us, we have to know the working of those dominance beforehand. And so the battle of those archetypes at Jericho is a way of saying if we look at that battle and understand that battle, that gives us the ability to anticipate the effects before the causes, which the other side is talking about.
Exactly. And for people who don't know the phrase, the Battle of Jericho, that's a biblical story way back there, Old Testament, and somebody blew the trumpet and knocked the walls down. So the Battle of Jericho is the increasing merging of media forms, which we're very familiar with now. It wasn't so familiar, 100 years ago. So it's the merging of things. But there is a tactile reaction and faux separation that's attempted. But I mean the imploding factor in the title
right,
here.
Right.
And they're so fighting. They're resisting the implosion,
Right. So the characteristic difference between ourselves is that I see that battle as going on all at once, and so the various possibilities of archetypal interaction occurs along a spectrum of possibilities. So at the extreme ends of the spectrum, you have merging, and then towards the center, you have more and more differentiation of the archetypes. And so the instant view, you could say, is a kind of dancing on that spectrum all at once. Whereas what you prefer to do is look at the dancing on the spectrum in chronological time, so that one identification of the battle takes place at one time, and then that instigates another and another time. And both of those views are correct. It's not the case that the story of the universe and the story of human beings in the universe is timeless, and it's also not true that it's only chronological. It's both together.
Right.
And so what we're talking about in our characteristic ways is how to think about all of this stuff in a way that fits sort of both our inclinations.
Yes, and you'll be delighted to learn that, yes, this chart is more sequential, but the tiny note chart is meant to be simultaneous, as you will see when I explain it.
Good.
Yeah, so there are two types in my charting. But there's the ALP serves as bottom-up, and HCE is the male attempts to manage or bureaucratize the effects that they see, which are usually a step behind. And I guess we'd have to say in the West, it tended to become a patriarchy. Men dominated the left hemisphere actions of bureaucracy more than women, though maybe there were different phases in the what was called the Dark Ages, 500 A.D. or CE, 500 Common Era, before the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne. There was apparently lots of, sharing, exchanging, flipping of roles in the less literate, less visual space oriented Dark Ages. Do you know about mm-hmm. that?
In a society that is less ordered, I think that's more or less inevitable. And the reason for that is that there are always different spheres to life, some of which are controlled by women, some of which are controlled by men, and some of which are controlled by both. So in a society where there isn't much what might be called national order, where order is local, it's inevitable that women have a greater role in that, because women are the chieftains of local order.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, the men range. William M. Thompson, a McLuhanite, he does a lot of writing on these points in the early Neolithic phases, when the women tended to be back at their little central place and doing the gardening and cooking while the men roamed around hunting. I don't know if that's true, but, you know, much anthropology, archaeology, and whatever evidence we have points to those two roles way back there, after we started to settle down from the Paleolithic.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first division. And Thompson points out that women created, they were the first scientists. They measured their menstrual cycles up with the moon cycles. So they had little measuring devices. That's an interesting point, right? Science
sure.
begins with women.
Well, the moon was their measuring device.
Yeah. They had some other thing, I can't remember right now, lunar stick or something. There was some where they put maybe the markings.
Well, there was research done on that. There was a man by the name of Alexander Marshak that studied markings on bones and wood microscopically. And he tried to show that there was early calculation being shown in these things. But I think his research has largely been discredited.
That's right. Thompson talks a lot, quotes and handles Marshak a lot, and in the end doesn't agree with him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so Marshak was found to be limited or something, you know.
Right.
Maybe projecting too much male positions on it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of feminist stuff that, attacked him or disagree with him, and Thompson tended to favor the feminists in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's a far greater appreciation now of how localized culture was for hundreds of thousands of years. And that trying to talk about culture as new or old Stone Age really doesn't apply across the universe of small local cultures that were going on.
That's right. Okay, so again, this chart, like the bottom up and top down, so I'm putting the two of them together. A more complex chart with the same point to show the movements of media interacting over a span of time. You'll see in the homeopathic, not homeopathic, the tiny node chart, I move out of McLuhan. It's not all McLuhan. But this is a straight ahead McLuhan, because you've got here, take the first era, telegraph. That's under ALP, and under HCE, you get particular dating, 1750 to 1800. So I have the telegraph being made before, 100 years before it was made, technically, by Samuel Morse or whoever, you know, 1840 or so. I start off 1750 because that's when Ben Franklin is doing his kite flying experiments, trying to figure out electricity, right? So he's helping to build the telegraph 100 years before. In that sense, that's on the efficient causality level, that's the effects preceding the causes there. See, so I make it a broad span there, 1750 to 1800. And that is going to take the effects of print and make them more rigid. So it locks down centralization or bureaucracy. So the ground is telegraphed, but the ground goes over a span of time. And it's conflicting with the medium, and the medium is the actors, Shimshon Essi. They are the previous environments and other figures, which is McLuhan's later definition of media. So in the telegraph phase, you have the technological / cultural enemy, and that's usury or the monarchy, older systems. Okay? You see, that's what their visions, you know, take Washington, George Washington. They wanted to make a new culture to get rid of the tyranny of the British Empire, which was probably usurious and heavily taxing. So the telegraph inspires Washington's as a figure, and Washington is going to use manufacturing to create a wealthier culture than the British, who are based on usury and monarchy. So that's the war there. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And what's interesting to me there is that this is a very Innisian line. I'm referring
yes.
to Harold Innis.
Yeah.
So what you seem to be saying to me is that with the technology of the telegraph, you tend to heighten centralization in the same way as paper and roads at one time enabled centralization in the Roman Empire. But this is a very different type of centralization, a more instantaneous one, relatively more instantaneous. And then typical reactions to this technology and to the centralization that it prompts are the children boxes.
Yes.
So the opposition to England, the favoring of manufacture in the United States, and the figure of Washington.
Yeah.
So I find that highly understandable and illuminating, no problem.
Good, because this is focusing on media as figures in the processes. So when I bring in the human form, I call it anthropomorphic, sociological, psychological mask or leg. The humans are a bit behind. So Washington is a major figure for that period, 1776, and he's up against processes he has no clue about. And he is tending, telegraph is the beginning of software effects. And so the content is manufacturing, where America can really move ahead with that hardware, right? So Washington and his intelligence agencies and military under HCE are fighting the older paper software of usury and monarchy. You know, paper is kind of a software compared to hardware. But it is considered, in McLuhan's terms, a hardware environment as opposed to, what, coinage or pre-printing press money economies, right?
Sure. But all these things flip, of course, depending on if they're considered as figure or ground.
Right. So basically, it's a simple cartoon where I'm saying, okay, look at Washington. And you might know the dates of his battles, traditional and historical education, or fantasy education that are taught in the, you know, young schools. But okay, you begin to have a media ecology perspective by saying, look at this figure. Now he's fighting he's promoting manufacturing. He's fighting a printing press culture over in Britain, and he doesn't notice the Telegraph. You know what I mean? So, and then you see the centralization, or basically 19th century's nationalization starts to become a big deal. So you're supposed to see a process across the board here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the next one, electric software, which is what I'm emphasizing, because there's all kinds of other technologies going on in the hardware manufacturing world. But I'm making a broad outline emphasizing electric media, getting us into the 20th century. That's what I'm trying to probe to. So the next one is movies, for my purposes, right? And you're to see that the enemy of movies is the newspaper, because the newspaper would probably find, well, the cliche is that when Hollywood started to surface, say, in the 1910s and 20s, there was a den of debauchery from the moralists of the newspaper world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So movies are affecting, and you have a hyper figure like as illustrated in Citizen Kane, the movie. So you have this sensationalist guy up against other sensationalist papers, and they think they're fighting the book. They don't know the movie's coming down the pike as an environment, maybe, or how it's going to change the newspaper. So now this movies, you know, I've got Jefferson 1810, and this is 1800, 1840. Movies aren't for another 60 years. So this is the effects preceding causes. And McLuhan wrote about how the first symbolists, the Romantics, had a lot of cinematic effects in their poetry. He saw 19th century poetry as anticipating cinema. So I have that in mind, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So here it is, the figures, Jefferson, 1810. He's in a process that's going to lead to industrial government. Its centralization includes that, but the barons, what are they called? Robber barons, people who make new environments, a new industry, they become incredibly wealthy and become more powerful than the civil agencies, the civil governments, you know, local, state, national. So I'm trying to show something new is happening in government or top-down control there. So the just like the manufacturers were the enemies against the usury, you have the printed book versus newspaper. And, you know, one of McLuhan's best quotes starts off Interior Landscape, the first Joycean essay, where he quotes Lamartine in 1830 talking about the newspaper. Lamartine predicts will be in charge of information and perception by the end of the 19th century. It's an incredible quote. If you, and he says the book arrives too late. You know?
Right. Yeah. There's a nice flip there. Excuse me. Between the first three boxes of your movies line, it seems to me what you're talking about and what I find interesting is that the centralization has continued to increase.
Yep.
And this can be seen as a movie effect, because what the movies do is they move away from local production and local distribution into national distribution. Everybody goes to see the same thing.
Yeah.
So the enemy of the movie is the newspaper, because it's only local.
Yeah.
And it does not, at least at this time, have national distribution. excuse me, I've got a continual frog in my throat here.
But do you want to, you know, spit? Take a break, spit?
I'll just take a little drink of my coffee here. So then your next box is the printed book. And the printed book is a way of taking the print that is in the newspaper, but making it national in distribution.
Yes. And there's
so the what you call the movie effect is at work in the printed book. And then if you look to the end of the same century, the reason that the newspaper can be said to take over from the book again is that when printing becomes less centralized and more customer-oriented, then you can make books that are, in effect, newspapers.
Yes, and I was thinking the pattern McLuhan noticed that many of the famous novelists in the second half of the 19th century were started off as journalists, like Charles Dickens.
Yeah. Sure. You can even think of Poe already
yes.
setting that standard.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, that's a very good observation. So we move from 1800 to 1840 lockdown industrial government to 1840 to 1900 lockdown electrical government. And actually, those years, there is no electrical government, but this is about anticipatory mimesis, effects preceding causes largely, and early forms of the causes merging with effects. But those are causes in quotes. So that's more surface, ephemeral causes or visible causes, maybe in the realm of efficient causality or material causality, new ideas in material causality. So the next one is radio, and that's 1860. Mr. Lincoln is a major figure, and McLuhan used to say that the telegraph caused the American Civil War. So there's the enemy, telegraph, and oratory, which Lincoln was a great demonstration of, and many of the politicians in Europe were great orators. So it's the last gasp of speech, maybe speech as art form, and it's going to be swallowed up by radio, which, and the content of radio isn't just speech. It's also the tactile silence of radio is the content. So that's pretty obvious what I'm saying there. Any points you want to say?
No, okay. I really like the movement that is involved in this chart.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like the work of Harold Innes, but more focused, and it also has an immediate dynamism that I like. So you're showing that the media work forwards and backwards in time, and they have contradictory effects, and the those effects also work forwards and backwards in time.
Exactly.
So in order to understand what's going on here, you have to imagine individuals and whole cultures kind of dancing. It's as if they're on a top that is constantly turning, but also the top itself is undergoing transformations. And so the individuals and the collectivities constantly have to find new balance because everything is changing around them and under them. And what you're showing is the kind of concrete moments of this dance on top of the top.
Exactly. And I think the phrase, McLuhan, like macroscopic gesticulation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you've mentioned this twice. A tremendous book is Empire and Communication. I think it's plural, maybe, communications with an S. But that's a year before the bias of communication, which is 51. And we hear about the bias of communication when we start reading about McLuhan, because that mentions McLuhan. But what you're describing, Innes does an incredible scholarly detail. You know, back there 2,000 years, he works it right up to the 20th century. But all these amazing historical scenarios of different dynasties and the media they used, and then the media would be taken away and other effects. It's you're right. This is very Innesian, what we're doing here. But if you want to...
We just mentioned that the Empire and Communications was, first of all, a lecture series in Oxford in 1948.
Yes.
And although McLuhan always said that The Bias of Communication was the first book he read of Innes, that was false. In fact, McLuhan mentions in his letter to Innes early in 1951 that he had already read Empire and Communications, and he comments on it.
Yes.
So the influence of Innes on McLuhan has been completely displaced from when it really happened, which was around 1949 to 1951 or 52, which is when McLuhan remembered it, but falsely remembered it.
Yes, the McLuhan told me through the Evergreens that he really appreciated Innes because it allowed him to take an authoritative scholar in Canada and in the world and use him to anchor what he was already messing with in the 40s, early media analysis. And he said, I might have said, did you put him on? And he says, yes, way more than you realized. I, you know, squeezed him for all I could get to the hidden ground was a satirical element. He was satirizing Innes in the long run. That's what he said. So Innes was the perfect figure, establishment figure that McLuhan could work on many levels with. So that's interesting. So
I think what he's talking about there is by satirizing, I think he means that he could put the Innes mask on, but he could also take it off.
Yes. And he even writes that in 53 in his essay, The Later Innes, and, you know, doesn't hold back, really criticizes some of, from his perspective, Innes's less aesthetic qualities that McLuhan mm-hmm. liked to go into.
Right. That's also a topic in his letter to Innes in March 51 was the rewrite of that letter. So sometime around the turn of 1950-51, McLuhan wrote to Innes and said that if he wanted to understand these media figures better, he would have to turn to art analysis.
Yeah. So when did he finish Mechanical Bride, which comes out in 51? Is he writing that letter before reading The Bias of Communication?
Well, you see, the problem with that question is that The Bias of Communication is a collection of essays that were written starting, I think, in 1946 and coming up to 1950 or maybe even 51. And McLuhan had read some of the essays in Bias of Communication when they were issued.
Wow.
So, and he was doing that through Easterbrook, that was sort of Innes's secretary and
Yes.
His very good friend, and who had been McLuhan's friend for decades back in Winnipeg.
Yes, so I see McLuhan highlighting the bias of communication because it's a great phrase, the bias of communication. Maybe
right.
More appropriate for pop culture than empire and communications for his own purposes. So, yes, he makes up a story. He's a poet there about who he's influenced by. And if Innocent, let's say Innocent was alive when McLuhan was saying these kinds of things, you say, Marshall, I think you got that wrong there. And that may have been what turned Havelock or alienated Havelock a bit from McLuhan. Those guys knew it had to be different in McLuhan's story than what McLuhan was known to be saying. You see
I don't see what you're saying then.
Havelock, when I was there at the debate or dialogue in 78 at Innes College with McLuhan and Havelock, and Havelock was not interested in talking to McLuhan. There was
right.
an antagonism there, and I remember McLuhan, it was his turn to talk, and he ended up looking like he was pleading for Havelock to respond, and McLuhan started to dig at him in a way. There may
yeah.
be transcriptions of those things. I don't know if that comes across in the transcription, but it was an odd environment. And
mm-hmm.
I just assumed that Havelock, was not intrigued by McLuhan. And it may be because he knew that McLuhan was lying, you might think, about his Innes relationship. May have not have liked that.
Well, first, I'll just remark that those lectures and the interface between McLuhan and Innes, I mean, McLuhan and Havelock, is on YouTube. So people can see that for themselves and make a judgment. It's perfectly obvious that Havelock was reacting against what, from his perspective, were superficialities.
Yeah.
For Havelock, what McLuhan was talking about needed to have a basis, and that basis needed to be articulated. So Havelock kind of represented scholarship in the old sense, and what McLuhan was trying to do was introduce a whole new way of thinking, and in order for Havelock to dialogue with him, and even more important, in order to start the dialogue with anybody, which is what McLuhan was trying to do, then Havelock would have to let go of the need to have the scholarly articles and the footnotes and all that stuff, and jump over to where McLuhan was.
Yes.
And that kind of tension was going on between them.
Yes. So, see, McLuhan, as Carpenter pointed out, was a collector of new, interesting ideas. He was a poet of ideas and scenarios. So Innes was just another passing thinker. It wasn't that, even McLuhan said, he's a footnote to all I wrote. Not true. Well, a footnote to what you wrote, Marshall, but not the way you dialogued with culture and people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The difference there.
At the same time, Innes was more than just a step that he was going beyond. When McLuhan came to Toronto in 1946, he remained very intrigued with American culture.
Yeah.
And was constantly thinking of going back to the United States. He thought that the environment, the intellectual environment, was more dynamic and more promising. And here was Innes, a Canadian, who had a very good feel for the situation of Canada between England and the United States. And as soon as McLuhan tuned into Innes, he realized that Innes was right in this respect, and that McLuhan needed to change his perspective into a more Canadian one.
Yep.
Which isn't to say a fixed one, but a more Canadian slash dynamic one than what he had. So Innes was very important for McLuhan in that respect.
Yes. We could say, you know, McLuhan liked to say we live 200 years every 12 months. You can take a couple of years, you know, 24 months of McLuhan's life and intellectual probing, and say that's 200 years. So during that 200-year phase, he was engaging Innes and the effects of Innes on him. But he quickly goes on to something else in the mid-50s, and then the late-50s, and then the 60s. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Oh, absolutely. But I also see that Innes was only one of the figures that McLuhan was engaged with, let's say, around 1950. That was the time that McLuhan was constantly talking about the Appelian form. And strangely enough, the Appelian form was something that Havelock at that time was discussing in essays that were published in Toronto.
So years later,
Havelock,
right? Years later.
Pardon me?
Years later? Published years later?
No, no, no. Right. No, no. He was, Havelock was talking about the Appelian form already in the 1930s. His first book was published in Canada in 1939. He talks about the Appelian form and its relationship to Poe in that book. And then in 1946, he published a series of essays in the first issues of Phoenix in Toronto. And that, it could be even called a history of the Appelian.
Yeah.
And so McLuhan was already greatly influenced by Havelock in the 1940s.
And he never mentioned. In his writing on the I say Appelian, that's how I say it, Appelian. But the Appelian, he's writing with Theo in his book in the mid-50s on Tennyson, no mention of Havelock.
Correct, correct. And that's a little bit typical of McLuhan. He often put on somebody's mask without attributing anything to that figure.
Yeah, I have an unpublished essay where he says that. He talks about, you know, great artists do that, and he said Joyce really influenced by Chaucer, but never mentioned it.
Yeah, yeah. So he there's a essay by Eliot. I can't remember the date or the title of the essay, but it talks about how great artists always are taking from other people without attribution. And that's more or less the artistic process.
Yeah.
And McLuhan cites that essay, or cites that passage from Joyce over and over and over again. I think he was quite conscious of the fact that he did that.
Yes.
Right? And he was also conscious of the fact that that's how chemistry and sciences work. Scientists always are taking up results that have been found by other scientists, and they question them and interrogate them and stuff. And there's no point in science to go through the history of those ideas. Of course, there was a history, and somebody could even be a historian of science, but for the working of science, only the now is important. The history has no importance whatsoever. And McLuhan regarded himself as a scientist in that sense.
Yep. And that's why the lack of footnotes in a lot of cases. And what was my thought about that? They, you know, when I read books, academic books, since the 80s. More and more, especially in the humanities or in the media ecology fields or cultural studies, professors were just processing their reading. So it'd be, you know, hundreds of footnotes of all these different books they were reading. And that's the opposite of McLuhan. They had to acknowledge every little idea. And maybe even had no ideas. They just got ideas from everybody else, but they hadn't acknowledged them. McLuhan's a radical in relation to that later trend.
Well, the idea that in your acknowledgments you have about 15 pages of people that helped your ideas,
yeah,
right, and then you have 10,000 footnotes, and everybody is doing this for everybody else. it's a way of getting ahead,
yeah,
right. When your name comes up for tenure, what you need is letters from all of these people that you acknowledged and all of these people that you footnoted, and everybody does that for everybody else, and everybody gets tenure, right? And nobody, and all of these people with tenure are constantly talking about, oh, we're not giving enough money to the poor in Africa and all this sort of stuff. But of course, the money that would go to the poor in Africa is going to the salaries and the bennies and the travel grants of the people that are doing the academic dance,
the academic footnoting.
Absolutely.
Okay, good point there. So back to the chart. So we come to television, and I don't have it here visible, but in the bottom up and top down charts, you know, you have the Global Theater, Global Village, and then the Global Theater. But the Global Theater starts, no, sorry, the Global Village, which actually was going on before Electric Environments, but McLuhan's Global Village, in pop culture terms, begins with the telegraph. So telegraph to radio is the global, no, to television is the Global Village, and then the computer, atom bomb, satellite, you start moving to the Global Theater. So, those aren't in this chart. So you go back to the bottom up and top down and see the division. But that's not important. This is largely the interaction of an ongoing process where those Global Vision and Global Theater, Global Village and Global Theater archetypes or markers are not important. The two charts in the 80s are didactic. They're showing McLuhan. This one, because I put the two bottom up and top down together, I'm beginning to get the interactive now-ness that you're talking about in this. So it's loosening up a bit. It's still sequential, but you'll see it explodes into the simultaneity of what I call Baroque spirals in the tiny note chart. Okay, so you got television. The interaction between movies, radio, telephone, and Roosevelt, and that's 1900, 1918, locked down one half of the world government. No, wait a minute. Did I do Lincoln? Yeah, okay. Locked down half the world government. That's World War One. There's still a lot of the Global Village to dominate, invade, and Roosevelt is in 1932, which is dated beyond 1900, 1918. So this, again, gets the flow beyond sequentiality. It's a blurring movement going on, right? So if someone just brought a literate eye to this and say, well, 1900, 1918, locked down half the world government, Roosevelt, 32, how's that fit? So that was intentional to show the effects over a span of time, preceding and consolidating, which you've already mm-hmm. pointed out.
Yeah, and which can already be seen in the Lincoln line.
Yeah. So it's pretty obvious what I'm doing there. So then you go to the computer and atom bomb. You got the automobile and the quark tune. What the heck is that? But before I go into that automobile, that's the beatnik, the 50s. The beatniks are racing around as cultural enemies. It's interesting, right? They're using the automobile, or the automobile is using them, the Jack Kerouacs and Cassidy and those guys, Ginsberg, and Gerd Stern, who becomes an important colleague of McLuhan. But in the 50s, the automobile is... the rogue medium in relation to this increasing paranoid concentration camp that the computer and the atom bomb is bringing in. You get it?
Yeah. So the automobile is quote unquote on the road.
On the rope, or
road.
on the road.
Yeah.
On the road. Yeah.
Right.
On the ropes too. But the and then Kennedy gets knocked out. And it's the lockdown of the, you know, I didn't explain the industrial government of the movies phase or the electrical government, but 1800, 1840 is a hardware time. 1840, 1900, you start to get into electrical, even though it is later, and radio is not even on the horizon, but radio is being built by Ben Franklin in 1750 when he's doing the kite stuff. It's all building on each other. So you got half the world government, World War One, and then World War Two is 1918-1945 in the computer and atom bomb situation. Now a quark tune, quarks were named in 1963 by Murray Gell-Mann, I think. And he got the word from Finnegan's Wake, and
right.
When McLuhan says in Mechanical Bride, 1951, that the ads and comics are characters, the person or the hardware media are starting to get swallowed up in the global theater, computer atom bomb phase. So I wanted to show that what McLuhan in the 50s calls the mass man is super civilized and subatomic. We are subatomic. We're electrical particles in the mid-20th century. So the media, like a cartoon, is itself becoming tiny. So I call it a quarktoon. That's what a cartoon slash quark. So that's a neolism. What is it? Syllogism? Neologism? What do they call when you make up words?
Yeah, Nihilism, I believe.
Or neologism. Something like that. Anyways, so I stick quarktoon in there for a little creativity or improvisation, but I'm trying to indicate that media are becoming subatomic and super civilized like people were in the media mix after 1945, you know, in the atomic bomb world, computer world.
But what I'm not following here is that you've been talking about technological and sociological and individual changes in form, in gestalt,
yeah,
in possibility. But when you talk about something becoming small, becoming tiny, becoming a sub-particle, you seem to get into a literal world. A world where you look and you say, okay, that's big and that's small.
Yeah.
Whereas before, when you're looking at history, it's not literal at all because the technological forms that you're dealing with are anticipatory.
Yes.
In a literal sense, they're not there. It's their effect that's there.
Yes.
Right? But when you say something is tiny, you seem to be saying that it's literally tiny. And
well,
I don't get that.
No, it's perceived as tiny as an effect because mass man begins to think he's tiny against these big electronic environments. I mean,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're speaking kind of from the inside out.
Yes.
Rather than from the outside in.
Yeah, and I'm saying the media themselves begin to feel they're tiny and transitional or ethereal or ephemeral.
Could you say that, for example, in regards to the atom bomb, that people feel powerless, and that smallness on their part reflects a dominant or dominance that are themselves powerless at the level of archetypes.
Yes, the McLuhan said about the atomic bomb, it only had a short life as an environment, unforeseen. It quickly got managed and or programmed. And what the American CIA or military did by the mid-50s is they went around to all the countries that were thinking of developing bombs or trying to, and said, if you set off the smallest bomb in New York City or something, we will nuke your whole country. That, so they had, that was programming, controlling the environment. And so anybody who was thinking of bombing the United States would have to contend with their whole culture being wiped out. You know what I mean? So
sure.
There is this. This was the cold world that McLuhan predicted in, or commented on in Playboy magazine in December 68. You know, mind your media men or you catch a cold environment. On the secret Big Brother level, this was the first cold management technique. Just go around and say, hey, you try to do something with us, we'll wipe you out completely. So, and then that got developed as more fears of rogue countries, rogue dictators or whatever might develop the bomb. We're still doing it today. So I thought it was interesting McLuhan called that, it was no longer an environment. It became programmed and controlled.
Yeah, yeah. Hello, McLuhan famously in 1939 said there would be no war, no problem. And I'm not sure that he wasn't too optimistic about the management of modern weaponry. He often said that there could no longer be a nuclear war because the consequences were so large, and therefore we returned to a smaller environment. But just because the consequences are so large, unfortunately, does not mean that it might not happen.
Right, but he's been pretty good. It hasn't happened yet. So he's pretty good so far. He saw that TV was a bigger threat than the atom bomb. So the atom bomb got programmed and sidelined as populations and management got distracted by the effects of television and computers and satellites on their civilians, on their citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a big war that some say in the United States was the LSD countercultural war. Was McLuhan says that in 69, blast LSD as chemical bacteriological warfare. Maybe he just said chemical warfare. And yet in 66, he's writing about it's the greatest art form of that period, LSD. It gave way more interesting and illustrative effects of the global theater than any other art form of the day. You ever seen that article?
I don't know that I have. I think what you're talking about is interesting.
Yeah, I'll have to send that to you. Reviews Masters in Houston, I think it is, the varieties of psychedelic experience. And he says, obviously, psychedelics are the closest to the anti-environment we need to this tremendous global theater environment we're in. And he says all the Gutenberg arts don't make it as anti-environmental. But 3 years later, he's saying, uh-oh, this has been misused or gotten out of hand, and now it's not an anti-environment in a way.
Is that a published article or not an unpublished one?
Might be unpublished. Yeah, I got it from the archives. I think it's unpublished.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So let me give you a little background here that's pretty interesting. That is that his best friend for decades, Bernard Muller-Jean, who was the best man at their wedding. He was the godfather of both Eric and Mary.
And so, probably Terry, the twin, right? They're twins.
Yeah, but they had to, have different godparents for the two twins.
Okay.
And they didn't, at the time, they didn't even want to double up Muller-Jean as both Eric and Mary. But there was some kind of screw up, so they had to come up with a godfather at the last minute, and so they tapped Muller-Jean again. So Muller-Jean was a huge influence on McLuhan, especially on family life. Muller-Jean had a great wife, Mary, who was a close friend of Corinne, and Muller-Jean and his wife eventually had 8 children, and kind of gave a living picture of a Catholic nuclear family to McLuhan and his wife that they attempted to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
So after the war, Muller-Jean had been working for the Navy intelligence in New York, out of Columbia University, and then became a market analyst working for McKinsey and Company. And one of the people that was an associate of his in McKinsey, and who was a author of several articles, I think.
What did you say was the name? Ian McKenzie?
No, the McKenzie Associates.
Oh.
The name, still the largest business consulting firm in the world, I believe.
Okay. I thought you said Ian McKenzie, which was Wyndham Lewis's name for McLuhan in Self-Condemned.
Ah, no. I'm talking about the fact that Muller-Jean was a partner up until like 1953 or something in McKinsey Associates. And McKinsey was doing consulting for IBM and GE and everybody else. And so Muller-Jean may have helped McLuhan get a small foothold with some of these people. But at any rate, the close associate of Muller-Jean at McKinsey was a very early advocate of LSD and published on it in the 1940s.
Who was that?
So, yeah, I'm trying to think of his name. I'll look it up and I'll supply it to you
as we
go along. But the fact is that McLuhan knew from Muller-Jean already about the potential benefits and potential problems of LSD already in the 40s. So at the same time that he was influenced by Innes and by Havelock and was tuned into cybernetics by Gideon and Don Thiel, at the same time that all that was going on, he was already knowledgeable about, or relatively knowledgeable about LSD through Muller-Jean.
Yeah, it makes me think of a person like Ezra Pound, who knew everybody in London and then Paris. You know, he's a magnet, and he meets and engages lots of people. This is what McLuhan was.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead.
He appreciated very much that he had been lucky in meeting, especially these great European figures.
Yeah.
Like Lewis and Gideon.
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, if he had been born earlier, he could have been in Paris in the 20s. Who's that Canadian author? McClellan, the guy that hung out with Joyce and everybody.
Yeah, I know who you mean.
Callahan, Morley Callahan.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think McLuhan, if he was the way he was in the 50s, back in the 20s, he'd be like Ezra Pound. He'd be a key guy, you know, switchboard with all kinds of people in all kinds of fields. So in that sense, Lewis was like that in a way, but more isolationist, and Joyce knew everybody. McLuhan distilled that vortices milieu in himself the way he was. He was the 20s brought back, so to speak, in the way he mm-hmm. related to all kinds of fields of experience and
right.
information. We don't, you know, the image that you see of this, you know, dour professor on the back of the Medium as a Massage album or any other pictures of him. Not, he gets a little more playful in the 70s wearing the Scottish stuff, but he looks quite professorial or staid in the published photos of himself in various magazines in
yeah.
the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
But he was
especially in the pictures in the UT Varsity.
Oh,
newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just funny. So I agree with you that McLuhan was a kind of switchboard in himself.
Yeah.
But he wasn't good, like Pound was, for example, in actually having these friendships, right? He was terrible at most friendships because he needed to talk so much.
Yeah, he was like Lewis in that sense. He was alienating.
Yeah.
Correct.
But he didn't. Lewis alienated through his temper.
Yeah.
And McLuhan alienated through his energy.
Right. He was super energetic. But many, on the Monday night seminars, he was quiet and attentive a lot. He didn't have to talk so much in seminars. He would end up talking. But you saw him learning from whatever the guest of honor provided. That's what they called them, the guest of honor, not the guest of honor. The guest
yeah.
of honor. He, you know, was quiet.
Right. I think he had, McLuhan gradually learned that he couldn't communicate, he couldn't educate by talking. That people tuned out. People were already experiencing what he talked about in a way that was antithetic to what he was talking about. So that had the effect of making him tired and making him more inclined to listen than he had been.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe he slowed down from his operations and that, and his illnesses.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But he still had energy, you know, at some point during the day. You could see it. He'd get energized.
I think he was, my understanding isn't as personal and as close as your understanding of him in the 70s, but I have the idea that he kind of flipped back and forth between a kind of hyper-frenetic
yeah.
activity and a need to lie down and snooze.
Yeah, that's right. Let's see, so lockdown, half world government, lockdown the other half. Trying to remember what it actually meant. I think it's World War I and then World War II. Two different, it was a vaster scenario in the Second War, and the American environment goes over the whole globe, not so
yeah,
much.
I think you were probably thinking in part of the difference between League of Nations and United Nations.
Yes, yep. You know, and the Americans were dominating the second one. So, and the Quark tune, In the 50s, you got television. So its content, at least on the news level, is comics, advertising, movies, radio, sports. I was thinking of the image, the icon taking over. But there were so many of them that it was tiny. And you'll see in the tiny note chart, I call the whole chart a particle accelerator situation. You know?
Uh-huh.
So that's where that's what QuarkToon is indicating. And
you could say that it's the explosion of the atomic bomb, but on a different level.
Yes. Yeah. So the let's see about Roosevelt. He's the longest president, so to speak, and then Kennedy's is one of the shortest. What pattern would be in that? The turnover of political figures. It's more and more celebrity who is taking over politics. So Kennedy can be easily forgotten. And then
you could say that the difference between television and computer and atom bomb, if we go down the vertically on the left-hand column, the difference between television and computer and atom bomb is that the electrical technology has increased in speed.
Yeah.
It's the same electrical technology, but it's much faster. And because it's much faster, there's new possibilities, both positive and negative. And that kind of acceleration, you could say, happens between Roosevelt and Kennedy.
Yep. You have a long stretched out. Remember Ennis's definition, the time-based civilizations like Sumeria stretched over thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, right? Whereas the space-based, the ones that got out and dominated, they were they got increasingly short lives. So Roosevelt is the time-based situation, like Babylon, say, I guess.
Yeah, like stone, right?
What?
You're basically contrasting what Innes would call stone and paper.
Yes.
Or stone and papyrus.
Right. So Roosevelt stretched out, so he's stone in time, and Kennedy is the shorter space domination and problems that the American environment is forced to deal with in a constant state of crisis.
As you talk, I'm beginning to understand the line better, right? So at the archetypal level, you could say you have the dancing QuarkToons, which are relatively small to each other, simply because interaction has increased more than it ever was.
Yep.
Which is the same thing that's happened between television and computer, and so then if you think of the opposition to that at the level of culture, then it's the automobile conceived as a trip from New York to Los Angeles, right? It's an attempt to reinstall an old sense of empire, an old sense of time. It's confused with freedom. But it's actually a replay of something that's past.
Yeah, and that's right. And remember, the QuarkToon also refers to the domination of Disney coming in.
Yeah.
You know, in that period. Okay, so the next one is satellite and laser beam. Laser beam is 1960. That's when it was discovered, invented. So this is 1945 to 1960, lockdown solar government, which means satellite, global theater stuff. The beginning of, it's called Echelon. Echelon is the secret network between Britain, America, New Zealand, Canada, Australia. It's the secret satellite management, which starts in the 60s. You ever heard of Echelon?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, global surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, last time you said that the tiny note chart was grew out of two of these lines. I think the satellite and laser beam line is not yet.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be homeopathic cliche probes and anthropomorphic physical.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, so this is the completion of the satellite environment, which I'm bureaucratically is the beginning of solar government, where you have the satellites starting to spy. I remember McLuhan had a dialogue with Bucky Fuller, and it was in the Innes Herald in the 70s, and Fuller gave the shocking information. He'd just been watching, you know, some government photographs from the satellites, and he was saying, man, they're going to be able to see the license plates on your car. You know, he was,
yeah.
That was a startling image in the early to mid 70s about the increasing power of satellite surveillance.
Yeah.
That's 50 years ago. So
correct.
It's amazing when you go ahead.
I just wanted to say the other day I found an essay of McLuhan from 1964, I think it was, where he was talking about the satellite environment. And there weren't any satellites yet.
That's
he
right.
He was already talking about it.
Yes. So he has in 62, I think, he's talking about the satellite environment turning television into archetype, not art form, archetype. So that's 2 years before your article. Yeah, he was on it. He was studying the effects before the figure showed up, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when I look at these phases, and you think of the speed, the post-human speed of our environments today, it's remember, it was really, in comparison, it was very slow back then, even though for most people it was super fast. Intimidatingly fast. Okay, so the satellite and laser beam, you have not the automobile, you have the airplane. And that's Vietnam, you know, the airplane bombing with napalm and all that stuff. And it's up against television coverage. So the airplane's out there aggressive, and television is making the American or the West go inner, right, retreating from the images in their living room. The cliche that McLuhan was always talking about, the television war in the living room. And then Nixon is an effect of that. Nixon's a paradoxical guy. He's running in 68 on the part. He had been reading McLuhan, and he was advocating a new participation type of presidency. Yet he was mafia-linked and involved with the dope cartel starting to take over. So he was, I guess you could say for the physical body, he was a concentration camp creator or fascist, but on the image in the TV environment, he's trying to advocate some myth about participation in politics. So he's a conflicted character as you come into the global theater. And remember that quote I begin with, no politician is without conflict of interest in the 60s and 70s. So the airplane's like an outer trip and television is an inner trip. And it's inside an environment of satellites. And the laser beam means a hologram is created. So as the satellites go up, what McLuhan called the proscenium arch, it's starting to make an iconic image, not in television news, but in the collective effect of movies, radio, TV, and all the other sports and all this stuff, people begin to think they're living in a hologram or a room, like in the movie The Truman Show, that later movie. You know what I mean by that movie, Truman Show?
Yes, I do. But
yes.
I didn't understand the phrase that you used. Did you say more room? R-O-O-M? Or?
I think so. No.
You said people are starting to believe they live in an environment of, and then...
Yeah, maybe a room.
Or something.
McLuhan has that quote from Phineas Wake, you know, whirling womb world, world room, something like that. So I'm saying that the actual hologram, the laser beam, I don't think it became used in art by Salvador Dali till the early 70s, and we're dealing with 45 to 60 here, but the idea that a hologram could come up over the horizon in New York City and beam down on New York City. It's an actual picture on the cover of the Church of Subgenius book in 1983. People used to think that those that didn't like religion, that the Pope would conspire and make a hologram of Jesus come up over the horizon and everybody think it would be the second coming, or UFOs were holograms made by the Pentagon or something. But the idea that you were inside a virtual environment is starting to be felt before the hologram goes into action. That's what I was moving into, and that's where the word holopathic comes from. As you go from the late 60s into 70s and 80s, this hologramic effect of the global theater and then the global membrane, or maybe both at the same time, I see McLuhan uses the phrase global membrane, I think, first in 1964. The effect of that implosion means that the hologram gets smaller and tighter, and digital miniaturization starts to happen. So holopathic is a combination of hologram and homeopathy. Homeopathy deals with very tiny amounts that still retain the memory of the substance, even though very invisible. So the hologram that people are living in is getting smaller, and it's also still a hologram effect. So there's more quarktoon, the miniaturization of people. But at the same time, they are being expanded by the digital technologies. And let's see, Nixon in 68, then Reagan in 1980. Now, you see, all the way through, newspaper, movies becomes quarktoon, television becomes television in the next level, moves across to the other column, goes from cultural enemy to weaponry. The computer and atom bomb goes from cultural enemy to to weaponry. So you see that mechanical process there, right? In each what would that be? Shem and Shang, they hop over each other.
Uh-huh.
Do you see that?
Yeah.
Right, so that's the part of the movement. So then you have Reagan, and he's locked down universal government. Now, in the late 70s, early 80s, the fad of looking for UFOs really takes off. And a lot of people are involved with UFO culture. And so the solar government is the immediate solar system, but universal government gets into light years and other dimensions. So the holopathic cliche probe, the hologram's getting tinier and broader and more involving, and it's swallowing the physical universe. So that's a whole process that's going on there that I'm trying to show how huge it is by calling it universal government. People's imagination is all over the universe in the 70s and 80s. You know, Philip K. Dick's novels are about that kind of phenomenon. It was common for people to think that they were touched by an ET or something, an extraterrestrial. Do you remember these popular phenomena, popular fads?
I do. I'm, I guess because time itself is getting faster for these periods, I'm not seeing as readily as I did in the lines above how the technology is moving, both vertically and horizontally. Up until computer and atom bomb and satellite and laser beam, I see how that works. And then satellite and laser beam to homeopathic cliche probes, you seem to move from a kind of technology to something that is more than technology.
Yeah. This is the weird virtual realities might be the term that's coming in. Homeopathic was, and I explain it in the book, how homeopathic is a term for memes and virtual images that are taking over, virtual iconography, and people are more involved in it, living in it. So there's a major rupture from the end of the global theater, which is satellite and laser beam. We're now moving into beyond the global theater. And you could, and that's when I call it the Android meme. So this is a very strange period from Reagan through Perot and then me, 1960 up to 2020. So I show that process from the homeopathic cliche probes and the anthropomorphic physical in the tiny note chart. So the tiny note chart develops what you're kind of complaining about. I don't understand what this change is. That's what I'm trying to show in the tiny note chart, and I'm calling it the Android meme.
Okay. And so am I right to think then that between the satellite and laser beam line and the homeopathic cliche probe line, what has happened is that ground as technology has been swallowed by ground as image.
Exactly. This is the quote in did I bring up Zingroni's book?
You did last time, yeah.
Yeah, in that quote, page 246, where the user consumes form. You remember that?
Yes, sir. I think you said that was the very end of the book.
Yeah, it's near the end. What he was trying to get at is what I'm talking about, homeopathic cliche probe. The fantasies of people, what they were living, you know, cyberpunk science fiction takes off, crazy huge movies with, you know, huge effects takes off. People have lost contact with even technological environments as they're laid out earlier. They're in a nervous synaptic ecstasy of what Baudrillard called the ecstasy of communication. You know, this real dramatic alteration. And, of course, the irony is the president becomes a guy from a small town, representing small town chemical body values. You know, Reagan?
Right.
You needed an extreme figure, an actor, not even a politician, so to speak. You know, and Trump develops that even further. Each president is after Reagan, but Reagan is a shock to people. But he's a figure for what's going on in the homeopathic process.
Yeah. So you could say that one half of Reagan is from Dixon, Illinois, and the other half is GE.
Exactly. Yep. He's a cyborg.
But, yeah. So would I be right to say that what happens between satellite and laser beam and homeopathic cliche probes is that the two columns, the ALP column and the HCE columns, have become flipped?
Yeah.
And now with homeopathically shaped probes, we have HCE as ground. He's not a good ground, but he is the ground.
Yeah.
And the ALP has gone over to the other half and is the reaction to this new ground.
That's feminism. That's the second wave of feminism and women taking over a lot of prominent positions in the iconography of media. Right? They become the top-down managers. They become the spy bureaucrats. And that leads to political correctness.
Sure. Well, just think of the woman that's head of CIA right now. And Biden has named a woman to be head of the national security.
Yeah, that's the rigidification of what's been going on for 50 years.
Right, right. But I just want to get back to this idea that the ALP and HCE have flipped.
Yes.
I understand how HCE works with homeopathic cliche probes, but on the universal government side, is there an ALP dimension to that or not?
Yeah, that's the spiritual feminism. That's the ISIS cult. Women,
okay.
Women get very involved with archetypalizing the woman as goddess.
Okay, so it's the Playboy fool, though.
No, feminism rejects that. You know, Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, but the ISIS is not only a controlling figure; she's also a woman.
Right. The patriarchal gaze, the subject of the gaze that GAZE that. A lot of cultural studies gets into the gaze, which is visual space,
mm-hmm.
patriarchal.
Yeah.
But women are fragmenting off. They're creating their own world. They're celebrating the history of women in many ways. Did you ever see that art form, The Dinner Party, by Judy something?
I think I did.
Yeah.
I think I did see that.
Yeah. So
years ago.
Yeah, so the women are... archetypalizing, romanticizing, or signifying the female figure in history. So that becomes the cultural control point like men were before. Women take over, and McLuhan said that women will take over all the older industrial environments.
Sure, because women know about roles. And
yeah, they can be better role players. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but I think what I'm beginning to understand here is that if homeopathic cliche probes as HCE becomes ground, then on the other side, women, that is to say ALP, gets involved as figures that are, you could say that. They are dancing homeopathic cliche probes as trying to understand what they are, right? So they're going through this kaleidoscope of roles as figures based on this new ground.
Right, and you said they're trying to understand what they are or become.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
because there's so many... roles and so many possibilities for women that they weren't allowed to explore before, or it didn't occur to them to explore before.
Yeah.
But now that homeopathic cliche probe is the ground, then it becomes obvious that that's what they have to do.
Yes, and I actually show this in this flip that you're talking about in the tiny note chart.
Okay, good. It'll be interesting to see that.
Yeah, now, what do you got? 15 minutes left?
let's say, I mean, all that can happen, well, yeah, maybe we should think about 10 minutes, because I'm a little worried that my nephew might phone and it might interrupt the recording.
Well, that's okay. But yes, we, 10 minutes, okay. So we've got here, well, we've done a lot. The computer and atom bomb versus the television in the homeopathic cliche probe. So we're moving into the digital. And then the anthropomorphic physical is humans are not being extended anymore. The machinic, as opposed to machines, where the homeopathic cliche probes of environments are interacting and extending each other. So the Coker developed this a lot. The surplus flesh, the chemical body, physical body being sidelined, then humans, what are they going to see as their projections, you know, the anthropomorphic impulse. They can see machines in themselves, and we've come to the point today, I was talking about this on my show, you got Chinese, Hong Kong people marrying their dolls. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, in Japan, I think that's where that's
Yeah. Yeah, so there's confusion of what the heck is anthropomorphic. Or it is anthropomorphic to project human qualities into the object. So I'm saying that there is a rawness to being in this post-holeopathic phase. And I'll go into more of it in the when we do the tiny note chart next time. So you have the satellite laser beam. Now is cultural enemy. And that's Star Wars or invasions, UFO invasions. You know, technological cultural enemy is a satellite laser beam turning in on us. And then the weaponry is computers and atom bomb. That's when people are worrying about third world countries getting the bomb. You know, nuclear terrorism by small countries or not even, you know, industrialized countries, like Iran, maybe.
North Korea.
Yeah, North Korea. So now, why Perot? So Reagan, in a way, is the last American archetype of a centralizing White House figure. Perot is a rogue. People are into decentralized people. People, marginal heroes from the margins, or what were considered the margins. So Perot is a symptom of that. Remember, he'd get on TV and give lectures. He'd instruct the people on the economy.
Sure. Yeah.
And McLuhan said Castro was like that. He would have long, involved educational instruction talks with the population through radio. And he had many roles. Perot is people looking for a classroom in the media implosion, excess, alienation, post-human, all that stuff that the mosh pit of the homeopathic cliche probes makes people want to get something serious going on in the media. Now, we really have that now with the Jordan Peterson phenomenon. You know, over the last 5 years, people have surprisingly got into watching lectures and dialogues on the computer or in their smartphone. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Sure.
Yeah, so this instruction, people getting back to classes as entertainment. And so Perot was an interesting prefiguring of this. And it's mythic, meaning there's McLuhan's definition of myth, which is an encapsulation of a lot of processes that become a reduced formula, but it's a multi-level formula or capsule. Also, it can refer to virtual, more and more virtualization of communication. So we've moved out of the physical, the solar, the world government, the solar government, the universal government, though there's a lot of weirdness in the interdimensional stuff in the universal government. Now we're, where are we when we've got mythic government? We're not in any human coordinates, actually. But it's bounced off by a human giving a lecture as a campaign. I mean, giving instruction in his campaign, which is what LaRouche used to do all the time in his campaign commercials in the 80s. But Perot, do you remember these? Perot's half-hour seminars? And so that's showing even wealthy, supposedly successful, creative, innovative people, business, what did McLuhan call them, emperors, looking, having an identity crisis, right? There's something bigger. To have wealth and all these different things that are associated with the upper 1% is not enough in the process of absorbing the information society. It's more important to figure out what's going on, or to think you've figured out what's going on, or you're motivated by the drive to figure out what's going on, which McLuhan says back in the 60s in a Tony Schwartz recording, in the future, all we'll have to do is to keep up and know what's happening. That'll be your main job, he said.
And so, you'll be paid for that.
Take a part, yeah, and be paid. And so Perot, and I did this in 95, that's a pretty good projection there by me about the significance of Perot as a pattern that's going to unfold in every election. There's going to be a Perot kind of character. You could say, who's the guy who did the automobiles? Ralph Nader, a Ralph Nader character. Remember, he ran a couple times as a sober teacher. Let's sober up people and get serious, right?
Yeah.
And that's and that's after the cartoon Reagan. So it's very different in the Perot phase.
So let me ask you about the vertical line going from homeopathic cliche probes to the anthropomorphic physical. Is the issue there that the with the homeopathic cliche probes, there is kind of dancing of figures, whatever they are, right?
That's the question, whatever they are. You remember the Talander has the dance of thought among words. This is what we have, the dance of post-environment, virtual weirdness, interacting with flesh or what people think is human. You know, they're
correct.
Not sure.
Correct. So that's the movement from homeopathic cliche probes to anthropomorphic physical seems to me to be the movement from dancing images that are in the end are only confusing to the question of, well, in this confusion, what is it to be an anthropoid?
Yeah.
What is it to be a human being?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which McLuhan got to that kind of questioning. Who are we?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, in the background, that you could say that's the dynamism. The dynamism of that question is at play in the whole chart.
Is what the whole chart? What was the verb?
Is at play in the whole chart. And it's also at play in the persons of Joyce's family.
Yes. Joyce's what? Hanlon?
Family.
Family,
I'm sorry,
right.
Family.
Right.
Am I talking so indistinctly, or what's, is it just the phone is not?
No. Yeah, no, it's okay, but sometimes it's a little blurry. I miss a word.
Sorry.
Yes, it's the family. The interactive, who's the mother, who's the father? That became a problem in the nuclear family. Who's in charge here?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so the...
It turned out to be the teenager that was in charge.
The what?
Teenager turned out to be the one in charge.
Right, so as we've gone through this, I don't know if you could take any other thinker and make a chart like this. You know, built from McLuhan's thinking. This is where the chart comes from.
It's not just McLuhan, though, right? This is, I think, what's not understood by the Bob is Nuts people is that to conceive of this kind of chart built on McLuhan is itself a contribution. It's not just a replay of McLuhan.
Right.
It's a recreation.
Yes. Perfect. Yes. The it's didactic, but it's more than didactic also.
Yeah, well, there's a play involved, and you have to understand the humor in the play.
Yes,
that's working.
So then it becomes Finnegan's Wake. You know, I'm illustrating Finnegan's Wake too, or applying Finnegan's Wake, like McLuhan
mm-hmm.
did, updating
mm-hmm. it. Sure. Well, explicitly at the top, where the ground is Joyce's family.
Yeah. So we come to the final level. And this is talked about in my tiny note chart, but it is amazing for me as I understand it. I predicted Ion here. It's incredible because there's a nothingness to the lines under ALP, right? This is like static. You know, lifeline, blah, person died, right?
Sure.
You know, when the, what do you call those machines that people, it's going up and down, and it goes, it just becomes a level tone, and the person's died. What are those things called?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a monitor or something.
Yeah, flat line.
Yeah.
So that's a flat line there.
The anthropomorphic physical eats itself.
Yep. There's something going on there, but I'll lay it all out in the tiny note chart.
Okay, good.
And how does it get to lockdown Bob Rule? What the hell is that? And how did I become president in 2012? Or a cultural
right.
figure? So that needs to be explained.
I think that's a good place to end because it leaves us with great anticipation.
Yes, many mysteries will be solved next week.
Perfect.
Okay, very good. So it's quite a chart, eh?
It is. And I want to thank you for helping me understand it better than I did or could when I was reading it.
Yes.
It's very helpful to have your sort of contemporaneous commentary on it.
That's great because, you know, we recorded this and other people can learn from it too.
Yeah.
So that's good. And I'm getting lots of great reviews of our dialogues.
Oh, yes. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
On the website, there's just one, I think, from somebody saying it's okay.
Right. There's in my Facebook page there's commentary. But people, like somebody the other day just said, "Keep them coming." They want more. No, it really works. We're doing something about McLuhan with McLuhan that's never been heard before.
Excellent.
Yeah. And people like it. Okay, so thank you very much. Let's hope it get all recorded. Yeah, it seems to be in the background. Okay, talk
good.
To you
well,
soon.
Well, yeah, talk to you next week, and thanks. It was enjoyable.
Yes, have a good week. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.